Hi, I am the Strategist Cowboy. This week's first and only contestant is the Gauloise Brune Ale Assortment from the Brasserie du Bock Brewery in Belgium. Brasserie meaning brewery. It has got a high ABV level, not unheard of, but high. I am setting it up against itself.
Let's get ready to rumble!
Our first and only contestant this week is thus the ale assortment Gauloise Brune, meaning Gauloise Brown. Gauloise Brown, Gauloise Brown. So the name indicates that this is a dark beer. I know it is a dark beer. The ingredients in the Gauloise Brune ale assortment are water, pilsner and caramel, hops, and probably yeast. The hops are of the sorts Saaz and Strisselspalt. The beer has got a European bitterness unit, or EBU, of 21. Surely an EBU of 21 doesn't suffice to give the beer a bitterness of 4 out of 5, like they say on the brewery's website. But sometimes beers can surprise, and there may very well be other ways to brew a beer with a high bitterness level in it. I personally think that there are. If there are, it is probably a secret how to brew it bitter. Some of the bitterness is inherent in the beers. They state on their website, bitterness, 4 out of 5, length, 5 out of 5, fruitiness, 3 out of 5, and finally strength, 5 out of 5, stars or whatever. The expiration date on this particular beer is June 2024. Today it is early September 2023. The Gauloise Brune ale assortment comes in a size 33 centiliters, i.e. about an 11 liquid ounces chubby round bottle. The two-folded bottle label is mostly brown and yellow in color. There is a picture of a 19th century building or something on the label, probably the old brewery. The brewery has been brewing beers since 1858. The Gauloise Brune cost 35 kronor at Systembolaget. That is about $3.20. That is $1.16 per every 4 ounces of beer. The preferred serving temperature on this beer assortment is, according to Systembolaget, 14 to 16 degrees Celsius, i.e. about 57 to 61 degrees Fahrenheit. That is almost as high as room temperature. Except the brewery says that the preferred serving temperature is a mere 8 degrees Celsius, i.e. only about 46 degrees Fahrenheit. But why would they say that? That is a lowly soda temperature and not a temperature for ales. What's going on? Surely this is not an export beer. It doesn't look or feel like an export beer. Well, they obviously export beers. They exported this particular beer. But I must believe that they also brew the same beer assortments for their domestic market. The Gauloise Brune has got an 8.1% ABV level. 8.1%. How about the experience then? Okay, let's see here. Nice yeasty aroma. It's got a 4 fingers tall head, at least a 4 fingers tall head. One moment. I just turned on the light so that I can see the color of this beer. Some extra light. It's brownish in color. Brownish. Orangey brownish. A little bit too, well, it's cloudy, but I can see my fingers through the glass, at least now, while I haven't poured up the rest of the beer. Well, it was a much more noticeable aroma when I smelled the bottle, on top of the bottle and the opening. It smelled fantastic, but now I don't smell so much. But it's a large head on it. First impression. It's a good beer. It's rich. Not very bread-like. No. Not that yeasty, that like it smelled. It doesn't come forth as very yeasty in the taste, but it's there. Yes, it is. And it's malty. Taste on my palate. A little bit fruity. A little bit, just a little bit. It's not much fruitiness in it. Is it sweet or dry? Let's see. It's a little bit sweet. But it's not very bitter or hoppy as they claimed it was. I mean, it's not a... What was it? 4 out of 5 or 5 out of 5? Let's see here. I'm gonna scroll up bitterness. 4 out of 5. I don't think so. But it's not bitter. It's another kind of bitterness, perhaps inherent in the beer. Perhaps. It's not candy-like. It's a little bit fruity. But not that. But it's well balanced. And there are maybe some spices. Or there is some spice anyway. Yeah, there is. The undertone is a little bit spicy also. And the carbonation level, I don't know. I usually find out a little bit later when I burp. It's not creamy, exactly. No, it's not. It's not acidic. Let's pour up the rest of the beer here. Almost the rest of the beer. It's got an equally tall head this time. And I can still see my fingers. I can almost see my finger through the glass. It's very faint, but I can see it still. There are no aberrations in it. It's dark roasted, but not very dark roasted. It's well balanced, I think. Yeah. And I don't think it's very much filtered or at all. I don't think it's filtered. But there's filtered beers and there are unfiltered. There are filtered beers. There is filtered beers and there is filtered beers, so to speak. And this is not very much filtered, or if any. But it's well balanced. Let's see here if there are any other flavors in it. They say on their website that it's supposed to be licorice aroma on it. But I didn't sense that. But is there a licorice taste in it? I don't think so. It's not especially licorice tasting. And they say it should be chocolatey and coffee-like. But I don't think so. Maybe chocolatey. A little bit, perhaps. But it's a good beer. Definitely. No raspberry, no blueberry, no mango, tangerine. No, there's nothing more in it. Okay, what about grading then? How many devils do I grade this beer? I think 8 devils out of 10 possible. It's a very usual grading for me, but common grading, but I think it deserves 8 devils out of 10 possible. A beer is a beer, so you should not pepper a review with lots of flavors that's really not there. I refuse to do that. I could say about anything I wish to, because reviewers or beer connoisseurs are actually pretty silly, most of them. Because they make up superlatives for any beer, almost, unless they really don't like it, and that's wrong. I won't do that. I think this beer is worth 8 devils out of 10 possible, and the flavors I mentioned are the flavors that I'm really sure of is in the beer. Other flavors would just be guesswork or whatever. This is what it tastes like. Okay, absolutely don't drink and operate heavy machines, military or civilian. Drink responsibly or not at all. Don't drink at all if you're underage or pregnant. The Viking. Is he normally adventurous and violent? I'm not adventurous and violent, but I still have a brother who was when he was young. Nowadays, he is as domesticated as a house cat. How could he grow up to become so different from me? That said, I had Viking blood in me. Aggressiveness was not the Vikings' philosophy of life. Control was their philosophy of life. The description on the continent and on the British Isles of Vikings as systematic rapists I believe to be gravely incorrect and given to them by the outside world in the centuries that followed, which later became a generally accepted historical description. All peoples, including the Romans, were slave-owning robbers at the time, if you want to look at it that way. It was rather the Romans who drove that development. Single or rare events have traditionally served as character descriptions of the Vikings, such as berserker gang and death cap eating junkies, or the blood eagle, which was a messy revenge that some Viking did to one of their kind for murdering his family. Google it. The only ones that I know of that have had the fortune to write their own narrative of history for the outside world to accept are the Romans, the United States, and Great Britain. Winston Churchill said it quite bluntly, "History will be kind to me, for I intend to write it." The Vikings, being small and for some reason hated countries, did not have that good fortune. Yes, I said countries, but perhaps rather mean areas of character. Romance, I'm looking in your direction. You were probably the instigator of all that hate. When you write your own history pretentiously, it becomes full of flaws, and it spoils history. But when you don't write it, someone else will. Incidentally, we are at the beginning of a new Viking Age, and the US doesn't like it. I guess they are having some issues with someone challenging the US Land of the Brave narrative. I know what makes you tick, America. What has not been understood in the Anglo-Saxon countries is that as a Scandinavian, it is possible to form a fairly good idea of who the Vikings were and of their customs by analyzing Nordic archaeology, which Anglo-Saxon historians have little knowledge of, and by studying the prosaic Edda, etc. Above all, Anglo-Saxon historians believe that we Scandinavians cannot understand our own ancestors, whom they admire, while at the same time they despise above all us modern Swedish men. I really understand how our ancestors felt, and I think they would have recognized themselves in me. The Anglo-Saxons claim that just as well as we Scandinavians, they can concoct a story about our ancestors based on the outside world's image of the Viking at the time, which they claim to be as true as the story we can build with all the inside information. They are not interested in going to the source to learn from those who know the most. I think their image of the Viking as a macho man is embarrassing. Since when did the macho man become the ideal warrior? Is it not the case that macho cultures lack the ability to wage war against another state in such a way that war must be waged in order to win victory? I personally believe that the Viking had full control over everything, including his own aggressiveness. He could unleash it, or he could have used standoff advantage, or the classic, he could make time-critical beach landings in places where the bigger state lacked larger military forces at the time. He could also withdraw if there was no prospect of victory. It depended on which was the best operational or tactical move at the time. Magnus Ernström, alias Morgonsur, has written a book which was very interesting to read. It is about the war in the Balkans, where he participated, so to speak, as a Swedish soldier in the Swedish battalion, also dubbed Skjutbat. Swedish veterans have told him, "Don't write how it really was, because no one will believe you." He has said that he intended to write it as it really was and ignore what the outside world says. For my part, I'm pretty sure that the number of foreign war geeks who have read or will read it, assuming they can read Swedish, is somewhere around zero. It will not be translated into English at the initiative of the outside world. I think it was the same for a long time with the Edda. It was hardly studied outside the Nordic countries. I have not yet had time to read the older Edda, Simon Sigfusson's Edda, which is actually the younger of the two writings, according to the most scholars. But I have closely studied Snorri Sturluson's younger, i.e. later prosaic Edda. It seems that the art of Skaldekonst was an equivocal language with information that could only be understood by the initiated, or so they were hoping. In the introduction to Gylfa Ginning, Nordic geography, countries and peoples are mentioned by their proper names. Gylfa Ginning and Skaldskaparmål clearly show that dwarfs is a paraphrase for the Danes. After studying the Skaldskaparmål, I'm also sure that Jättarna, i.e. the giants, is a paraphrase for the Germans and people on the continent, and that the gods, Asar, in the sagas, which Snorri retells, is a Swedish fabrication from the beginning. Valhall is located in Sweden, and Odin is a pseudonym for a Swedish nobleman. Thor is a Swedish army leader, whose hammer and power belt are code language for his means of military power. The tales in Skaldskaparmål describe at length a war between the Svechos, Swedes, and the Germans, or Jättar, i.e. giants, as they are called. A god's tale goes like this. One morning, the mighty god Thor wakes up to discover that his hammer, Mjölnir, has been stolen. The thief is Trym, one of the giants. He says he will return the hammer if the beautiful goddess Freya marries him. The gods come up with a plan and agree that Thor should dress up as Freya and Loki as her bridesmaid. The two leave for Trym's castle, where they are received with a party. Thor comes close to revealing himself when he eats almost an entire ox, but Loki assures Trym that Freya is just hungry. When the giant lifts the bride's veil to kiss her, he is startled by the intense eyes, and Loki tells Trym that Freya is just tired. She hasn't slept in 8 days because she's nervous about the wedding. When the giant retrieves the magic hammer to bless the marriage, Thor takes the hammer and kills Trym and several other giants. End of the story. Let's continue the reasoning. With the knowledge that Thor is a Swedish army leader and the giants are the Germans, one can easily interpret the Gudrasaga, i.e. Godsaga, like this. The army commander, Thor, is tricked by the Germans, the giants, who have usurped some control over a Swedish army corps, the Hammer Mjölnir, perhaps with the support from one or a few high-ranking German immigrants. This is not at all impossible. Even today, there are German-identifying high-ranking officers in the Swedish Defense Forces. They are nearly as dynamic and tough as the Swedish officers. Trym was a powerful man in Germany, what was called Jotunheim, the home of the giants, in the tales of the time. Trym wanted to force the Swedes into a German war in the east And to add insults, the Germans demanded trade advantages against the Swedes. There comes Freya and the bridesmaid into the picture, representing fertility and commerce. Thor does not accept Thrym's deal and is close to being exposed when he tries to win trade benefits for the Swedes while in Germany, against Thrym's bidding. Thor eats almost an entire ox. The character Loki reassures Thrym and the Germans by assuring them that Thor is only making preparations to carry out Thrym's wishes or demands for trade in specific goods. Loki assures Thrym that Freya is just hungry. Thor exposes the once again Swedish-controlled and combat-ready army to Thrym, as Thrym tries to exert influence on the Swedish army, who play along. The giant lifts the bride's veil to kiss her, but is frightened by the intense eyes. Thrym is received in Sweden and murdered along with several other prominent Germans in the entourage, whose job it is to ensure that the Swedish army is loyal to the German war goals. The giant retrieves the magic hammer to bless the marriage, and Thor takes the hammer and beats Thrym to death and several other giants. End of story. Interlude. Loki may be Odin's less accepted alter ego. There is evidence of this, as it has been interpreted as both Loki and Odin were a couple with Freya, and both Odin and Loki were portrayed as dubious and untrustworthy. Freya could also be Frigg's alter ego. But in any case, Loki was a dark-haired, brown-eyed Asa god. End of interlude. Another god's tale goes like this. The cheeky god Loki was part god and part Jotun, i.e. giant. Loki entered into an idiotic bet with two dwarves to see who could generate the most amazing treasures for the gods. Loki transformed himself into a fly to try and distract his rivals while they worked. Despite this, the dwarves won the bet, and Loki had his lips soon shut as a punishment. Assuming Loki was Odin's alter ego, then if Loki was a giant descendant, so was Odin. But it is unlikely that Odin was more of a Germanic descent than the rest of the Asa gods or Asas. I think Loki was probably pro-German, and he didn't care about race or ancestry, and was therefore considered unreliable. If Loki was Odin's alter ego, you can interpret the tale like this. Loki involved himself in hagglings with the Danes about strategic goals. An idiotic bet with two dwarves to determine how to go about making our regions richer. Loki used his main advantage, going deeper into himself than the Danes could, and making sure he got the last word rather than pushing the negotiations forward. He turned into a fly. Loki's tongue was tied so that he could not publicly say that the secretive Danes were Taliban-like oppressors of their women. Loki had his mouth soon shut. Okay, Taliban-like is a bit of an overstatement, but you get the picture. The secretive Danes, whose military power is still today shrouded in a cloud of thick obscurity. But you can be sure that plans are being made for the future, and that parts of Sweden are always the target. I think Scania's fate was decided in this bit. The story is a little more elaborate than it appears here. It is important to remember that the tales may originate from the small Viking age of the Bronze Age, but they have certainly been spruced up a bit during the Viking Age. Whether history has been repeated in detail, we do not know. The early god of war, Tyr, and the Asa tied the Fenris wolf in the tails, and Tyr stuck one hand in the gap of the Fenris wolf as security, but lost his hand in the process. Tyr appears to have once been an important god, but his influence had probably declined by the time the stories later recorded appeared. Muspelheim belongs to the Muslims. Ragnarök seems to be the Vikings' view of how their society would perish at the hands of the Muslims sometime far into the future. The poets of that time realized that a new Viking age would come long after their Ragnarök. That time is coming now. Interestingly, they apparently believed that doom would come from outside. I believe that a downfall will come from within ourselves. There is not much point in delving further into the tales, beyond mentioning the Bergdaner, i.e. mountain Danes, and Bergsaxare, i.e. mountain Saxons, who in my opinion were a mix between dwarves, Danes, and giants, Germans. And the names support my theories. Bergtumlare, i.e. mountain tumblers, Helgedomsdaner, i.e. shrine Danes, and Bergrumensinvånare, i.e. cave dwellers, are other names for giants. Read paragraphs 3, 17 and 18 of Skaldskaparmål. It is not necessarily the case that every time the Asa gods are mentioned in one or more stanzas that they refer to an individual Swedish nobleman. The stanza may as well have been written much later when the Asa belief had become a religion. But the continuity, the chronological order in Snorre's storytelling, is good for being recorded a couple of centuries later. It is clear that without Snorre's recorded explanations in the early 13th century, we would not understand anything of the Skaldskaparmål. But Snorre Sturlason must have had to add 2 plus 2 as well. It is clear that there were nation-states based on character traits in the Nordics during the Viking Age. The Skaldskaparmål works of poetry could migrate within the Nordic lordships. Why did they dictate like this, i.e. was there any underlying political purpose behind the tales and prose? Why didn't they just say it like it was? Is there irony in the tales? And if so, is it explainable? These are questions that we need answered. You have to try to get behind the tales to see their purpose, and it can be very difficult since 1,000 years have passed. Presumably, the purpose was to describe something in crypto to a closed circle of people in power, while avoiding classifying the material. In this way, there was no need for secret archives, but the little that were well-kept secrets could be memorized in the head and portioned out orally. We must not let ourselves be deceived into thinking that the Asa belief has the same face value as Christianity, as it is described in the New Testament, sort of explanatory, or that it would have a confirming side in the form of the Holy Spirit, like millions of people know exists. The Asa god tales bear a resemblance to Freyja von Münchhausen's insanely unrealistic and eccentric stories of his time. But there are also pure descriptions of wars, battles, and conflicts, which can be interpreted with the help of Snorre Sturluson's explanations. Because of the Anglo-Saxons' lousy source critique, the lies take root in the consciousness of the people outside of Scandinavia. Over time, prejudices become truth. In the TV series Vikings, one of the Vikings is subjected to something they call the Blood Eagle, a punishment which, according to the TV series, was reserved for those who displeased the gods beyond the ordinary. As usual is with myths, there is a grain of truth in the claim. Free men suspected of crimes in Viking Age society often had to undergo tests known as Gudsdom, i.e. deity verdict. Deity verdict could mean that the accused had to pick up stones from boiling water or carry red-hot iron. If you did not pass the test, you were considered guilty and could be fined, exiled, or in the worst case, forced into slavery. The Blood Eagle involves the offender kneeling and his back being cut open with a knife, and then the ribs are hacked away from the spine with an axe, the lungs being pulled from the gaping bleeding wounds and placed on the victim's shoulders to resemble the folded wings of a great eagle. Then the victim is left in agony until he dies. If the victim suffers in silence, he is allowed to enter Valhalla, but if he screams, he is not allowed through its gates. According to the TV entertainment series Vikings, that is, complete rubbish. Carving blood eagles was a form of elaborate torture with death as the end result, which sons, usually, of murdered lords used to get revenge on the perpetrator. It is thus not very different from the torture in medieval societies. To claim that carving blood eagles was a deity verdict is absurd. This is how myths are created, and it may very well be how the myths about the Vikings were once created, that fiction became pseudofact long after the Viking Age. Or it is pure psyop. I simply do not recognize myself in the image of the Viking as the Vikings are portrayed on the continent or in England. But as the Svitjo, Swede, Valgard dictated, quote, "Clearly, the strong ruler's fire burned over the city's defenses. The Vikings ravaged greedily. The woman was caused grief." End quote. It is therefore clear that the Norwegians were systematic rapists, also against us Swedes. But then all us Northerners have undeservedly suffered for it. Even the Nazi Germans did not rape women systematically in the true sense of the word. On the contrary, it was a serious war crime that resulted in the death penalty or forced referral to a penal battalion, which was the same as a death penalty. More recently, now that the last German survivors of World War II are starting to disappear, there have been attempts to attribute ethnic cleansing by systematic rape to German World War II soldiers. Ask any remaining German World War II veteran soldier how the German Wehrmacht or SS soldiers looked upon rape and rapists. They will explain to you with emphasis the contempt they felt for such persons who commit rape. The Germans did not rape systematically. At the very least, rape was not sanctioned in the Wehrmacht or in the SS war organization. That much we know. But there was forced prostitution in some concentration camps. For example, Buchenwald and Flossenbürg. This does not mean that the frequently visiting SS men forced themselves upon the women. Many of the women had chosen to improve their chances of survival, and others resigned and accepted their fate, just like some of the German women in the Eastern Occupation Zone at the beginning of the post-war period. Those who did not want to participate were free to choose starvation, lack of medical treatment, and slow death at worst. Prostitute German women were also among the camp prisoners. The SS did not discriminate in this. The various Zwangsprostitution camps were not death camps, but food was more scarce for the female prisoners who did not accept becoming prostitutes, and they could be deported to a death camp if they were Jewish. But if the Swedish Vikings were like me, at least they weren't rapists. Rather, they were gentlemen. It's funny how evil in history always seems to start with the Vikings. History always seems to begin with acts of violence from these regions or nations. But there never seems to have been anything that led up to the violence. That story has a tendency to disappear from the history books, as if the violent Vikings had suddenly just popped up out of nowhere from peaceful Iron Age people. Iron Age people who were transformed into bloodthirsty killers by a sudden spell. No, history is an unbroken line, and everything has a causality. The history of the Vikings was not written by the Vikings themselves, as the history of the Roman Empire was written by the Romans. The Edda, which was composed in the 9th century, but was not written until after the Viking Age, is not widely read by the world's citizens. This is the deepest divide between Roman and Viking history. Thank you, and see you later, alligator, at a while, crocodile.